I want to welcome you here this morning, and I heard there was a raucous party going on in the neighborhood, and seeing so much of Miss Violet's family is a joy, but does tell me where that raucous party was. Now, I'm very glad that that they're all here and that they've been able to celebrate such an incredible event with Miss Violet. We are so very blessed to have her for so very long, and to see such incredible profits from all of her labors and her family. And I appreciate all of you being here this morning. If you would, go ahead and open your Bibles, Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19. I got to be honest with you. I really wish people would stop asking me if I think such and such a thing from the Bible is fair. Because the truth is, I don't know, and you shouldn't care. You shouldn't care if I think something is fair or not. You should also respect that I am not the arbiter of what is fair or right or wrong. I'm not the one who determines such things. And in truth, I trust that God knows what is right and best regardless of what I consider to be fair. Besides that, when we're using the term fair, we should not ask for what is fair. Romans chapter 6 and verse 23 tells us that fair sends us to hell. If we got what we deserved, no one in this life would be in good shape. So to ask for what is fair or what is we consider to be just or right is an entirely arbitrary thing as far as I have considered in this world. The rules we find are the rules, and I don't change them, nor do I seek to change them, nor, if I'm really honest with myself, would I even want to try to change them? I would mess things up in all kinds of ways that could not be predicted ahead of time. God has established the rules. He has determined the appointed place for everything. And the only question that I have to answer is whether I agree to be part of that covenant or not. Not what the rules are in relation to the covenant. One passage here in Matthew chapter 19 I find incredibly interesting, because it deals with a number of social issues that we deal with today that all revolve around how I feel or how I think things should be done. But in Matthew chapter 19, it even begins with an interpretation. He says there in verse 1, he says, "Now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these sayings that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, 'Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason?'" Can a man under the old covenant, the Mosaic law, can he divorce his spouse for any reason he can come up with? Now, this doesn't necessarily seem all that important to us. It was incredibly important to the Jews of the day. There were two fields of thought concerning Deuteronomy chapter 24, which we'll talk about in just a few minutes, which concern the letter of divorce that a Jewish man was able to give to his spouse, his wife, if he found some uncleanness in her. Now, half of the Jews, approximately, at Jesus' day, believed that that meant you could legitimately divorce your wife for literally any reason. It could be because she burnt the toast one too many times. It could even be nothing that she particularly did, but you found someone that you find more attractive, more interesting, that you would like to be married to rather than this other individual. The other half of the Israelites, approximately, of course, they held that the uncleanness that Moses was talking about had to do with sexual infidelity. That a cheating spouse could be put away, or one that presented themselves as wholesome and clean before marriage, and you found out that they were not. That in situations like that, the offending party could be put away. And this was a huge divide in the land of Israel, as you can imagine. And what the Jews, what these Pharisees are seeking to do, it seems, in verse 3, is to pin him against at least half of the people in the Jewish society. Now remember this question because it's going to be important in just a few minutes. But we're not explicitly talking about marriage, divorce, and remarriage here. What we're explicitly talking about are five key concepts to the world that we live in and how Jesus legitimately answered those questions in practically four verses. Notice what he begins with when he responds to them. Verse 4, and he answered and said to them, "Have you not read?" What an amazing way to begin any topic, any discussion. Have you not read? And while he doesn't mean it necessarily in the way that we would sometimes like to utilize a phrase like that to be abrasive and somewhat verbally abusive, Jesus is questioning their context by which they are going to reason these things. And while they begin with the exception, which far too often is how people argue anything, culturally or otherwise, Jesus is going to begin with the rule, which is where you should always start. Always start with the rule. Then exceptions, as they are made, can be applied appropriately. He says, "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate." We just read exactly what Jesus is quoting, Genesis chapter 2. Now, some in the culture that we live in will argue that the Genesis accounts are allegory, that they are a fairy tale, that they were given in order to explain the beginning of the universe to people who were too dumb to understand how science and technology understand things today. Have you ever read theistic evolution or evolution to begin with? Have you read the scientific community's explanation of how the world began? Because it's absurd. Go into the scientific community and read some of the papers that they present. They are littered with enormous words that have practically no meaning, that just are meant to confuse and to subjugate the point. The point ultimately is they have no idea. They have no answers. But in order for the Christian community to feel more scientific and to solve a few of the problems that were really hampering them, or they feel are hampering them, they have come up with the conclusion that the Genesis story is a fairy tale, is false. But what does Jesus say there? "Have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female? And that same entity, which in the beginning made them male and female, also said these things." He established marriage, among other things. Jesus confirms the Genesis account. And while there are many individuals, and most of what we're talking about here has nothing to do technically with the social climate around us, with the Gentile world, as far as spiritually speaking, the non-Christian entities of the world, they are not going to come to the conclusions that we're going to come to from Jesus' message. But we have to realize that when we talk about these kinds of things, we are talking to people who at least have a concept of who Jesus is. There are a lot of people who love Jesus, but they want to get rid of the book of Genesis. They want to get rid of a lot of things practically. You can't have one without the other, because Jesus ties himself directly to the book of Genesis. He confirms the Genesis account, and practically that settles it. The book of Genesis is not an allegory or a fable, and Jesus would know. Genesis, or John chapter 1 and verse 3, he was there. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was with God in the beginning. All things were made through him, and nothing was made that was made. We say, who's the Word? Well, it's obvious. All of you are going to know who the Word is. John chapter 1 and verse 14. "For the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." He's talking about Jesus. Jesus was there. He is part of the Godhead, and as part of the Godhead, the Word in particular, he was the moving force in the beginning, in the creation of these things. So when Jesus is referencing this passage in Genesis, technically he is also referencing himself. The very thing that he would do later on when he talks about Abraham. "Before Abraham was, I am." Oh, they got it. They understood exactly what he was saying because they tried to stone him over it. If it was a simple misconstrue of grammar, I don't know. I mean, the internet goes kind of crazy, but over grammatical errors. But I don't know of anybody who's ever been people tried to stone a guy over being grammatically incorrect. It's because Jesus knew what he was saying, and so did the Israelites. He was claiming to be God. Jesus would know what took place in the beginning, and he establishes that the Genesis account not only is accurate, but that it is absolutely, positively the way it worked. The second thing we deal with here, have you not read that he who made them male and female? There were no mistakes made by God. The implication for the transgender movement, and in particular, again, what we're talking about is what is called the Christian transgender movement, which seems like an oxymoron to me, goes by the premise that perhaps God did make a mistake. There are even people who claim that very concept, that perhaps God made a mistake, and this person is not actually a male. They were born the wrong gender. But that implies that God makes mistakes. But in Genesis chapter 2 and in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus quoting these things, there aren't 15 genders. There's not 137 genders. There's not an infinite number of genders. There are, in fact, two. And regardless of whether we like that or not, again, immaterial, the point remains the same. These social issues that we deal with, Jesus didn't deal with in the same way that we do, but he legitimately gave every answer that we would need in order to combat them, to understand them. Now, some of the issues with gender dysphoria, with this transgender movement, and even in congregations that would consider themselves churches, and this appreciation or acceptance of such things, it tends to be an overreaction to how transgender concepts or people feeling out of sorts, gender dysphoria is what it's been known as for a long time. Folks have overreacted to medicating and solving these problems. And some of what we're experiencing today, I think, is in fact an overreaction to that, to how it's been handled in the past through shock therapy and incredible medical, incredibly terrible medical practices. But regardless of that fact, we cannot come to the conclusion that God created a multitude of genders. In fact, there are explicitly two, and we see that not only in the human race, but in every non-asexual organism in the world. There is a male and there's a female. When you get a pet, what's the first question your children ask you about the pet? Is it male or female? And how do you figure that out? It's pretty simple. In most cases, it's very easy to figure that out. And we accept that. And it's a concept that we all understand. And yet, when you allow people enough time and enough spare time to think too much about these kinds of things, this is the problem that you get. In a first world, you have first world problems. When you're not struggling to survive every minute of every day, these are the kinds of problems that arise. It's not surprising. You have the same situation happening in most what would be considered first world societies. Even in Rome, which would be, at their time, a first world society, they had similar situations, similar problems, because they had too much time on their hands. What happens when humans get too much time? They come up with some kind of nutty thing. And that's what happens. And Jesus here, he says, God made them male and female. Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, in the image of God, he created him, that is Adam. Male and female, he created them, Adam and Eve. It was very obvious that Eve was not a man. However you feel, through sexual interest or societal pressure, which I believe is quite a bit of this, he made you either male or female. And however you feel, however you think, it doesn't change that. When we can be gentle with people who are struggling with gender dysphoria, with issues, societal pressures that they're feeling in regard to these kinds of things, we can be gentle with people like that. We can be delicate with them. But we can't compromise on what Jesus legitimately claims as well as what the Bible explicitly demands. There are two genders. God didn't make a mistake. The third thing we're dealing with this morning, marriage is one man plus one woman. It's an equation that is from the beginning of time, like 1 + 1 = 2. In this way, in fact, if you read it, technically 1 + 1 = 1, the two become one flesh. But they become one married couple. They become one cohesive force, is the idea. And the argument concerning homosexuality is not whether it is natural or if they were born with certain proclivities. That's not an argument that's worth arguing, in all honesty, because that argument, again, relates back to how people feel. The question for a Christian and for individuals who are trying to do God's will, the argument is simply, what is the expectation of God? It's all the argument has ever been, and all the argument ever needs to be. We get sidetracked on arguments that have no effect, that are not only ineffectual, but problematic. We make it about things that it ought not be made about. Regardless of one's sexual proclivities, the argument is on the expectation of God. God determines what is right and what is wrong. We do not. Society does not. The law does not. The law can say all kinds of things are right and good, and it doesn't make the law of God any different. It doesn't change a single thing ever. Also, notice that man regularly thinks he knows what is best, and God tends to laugh about that. That we think we can decide on what is best for ourselves or what is best for others, and in truth, we have no idea. That's why I tend not to talk about what is fair, because I don't know, because I have no idea. I have no idea what should be fair or what shouldn't be fair. I only know, again, what God has described, what God has explained, what God has told me, and that I trust to be not only truth, but to be what is best, because he knows and I don't. He goes on here, chapter 19, verse 6, so then they are no longer two but one flesh, therefore what God has joined together, let no man separate. And we finally get to the issue at hand. Remember what the Jews are arguing. Now, whatever side of the fence these Pharisees would fall on, they will argue whatever is best for dealing with Jesus. They're going to come at it from however they think they can trap Jesus. So that's not to say that these Pharisees believe that you should be able to divorce your spouse for just any reason. They might actually fall on the other side, but they are drawing this implication, they are drawing this argument to Jesus specifically to cause problems and to isolate him from half of the Israelites. Jesus, rather than arguing from the exception that Moses made in Deuteronomy chapter 24 concerning the uncleanness that a man might find in his spouse, Jesus argues the rule. Think about their request. Their request makes no sense in regard to the rule. Half of the Israelites believe that you can divorce for just any reason. And if that be the case, then verse 6 means nothing. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. If you can separate over anything, then man can separate anytime, any place, anywhere, anyhow. The rule has no significance if this exception, this practically isn't even an exception. Practically, it should say, if the exception is the rule, practically, it should say marriage is kind of a thing. I mean, that's about all marriage would ever be if you could divorce for just any reason. And rather, what's happening here, we oftentimes take into the New Testament explicitly. But what's really happening here? Is Jesus establishing some New Testament biblical concept? Or is Jesus answering the question that they've just asked concerning what does the word uncleanness mean in the law of Moses, and the exception that Moses gives? When Jesus answers this, he gives the rule, and then notice how he responds. Then they say, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? And he said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. Interestingly enough, when Paul argues concerning marriage, practically every time he does in the New Testament, where does he go to establish the principles that he's describing? He goes to the beginning. He goes right where Jesus goes. They immediately go right back to the beginning where marriage was established. And they say, this is how it is meant to be done. Now, Jesus is going to administer the concept. He says, and I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. And approximately half of the people who are standing there are shocked. They don't know what to say. And perhaps they have already come to this conclusion from what Jesus is arguing. Perhaps they know where Jesus is going to go. But Jesus says, I'm just going to lay it out there for you guys. Divorce spawns from a hard heart. And I'll tell you, friends, that's always the case. Even in matters of this exception, think about it. Either it's divorce spawns from the heart of the one who refuses to change and stop committing adultery, or it spawns from the individual who refuses to forgive, even though the individual has stopped. So it's either a matter of not being forgiving, or it's a matter of one who refuses to change. The divorce always spawns from a hard heart. And in the law of Moses, Jesus recognizes that's exactly the reason this law was given. And in fact, if you read through it, and I encourage you to absolutely do so, Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, write it down if you would like. You see the implications of why the rule was given there in verse 4. It was so that a woman could not be divorced from one man and then the man take her back again later on after he had satisfied whatever desires he had with another individual. It was a means by which individuals couldn't be involved in multiple sexual conquests while still practically being married to the same person. I'd really like to be married to this person, but I legitimately want to have relations with these other people. And so I will divorce my spouse, and I will marry these other people one after another, and then I'll end up going back to my spouse later on. And that's what it seems like Jesus, or the law of Moses, this exception, was attempting to dissuade or remove from possibility. But you have to go back to the original question. Divorce, even under these conditions, not commanded, not demanded, that there is absolutely the potential for reconciliation, for individuals to forgive if the forgiveness is possible again, if the individual will cease, if the individual can forgive. And then he goes on. Marriage is for life, but one thing that not all mothers and aunts, family members can accept is that marriage is not for everyone. If you've been a single person for too long, according to your family, they will let you know. Especially, I hear, if your family's Italian. I don't know. I imagine that's pretty much any culture, but Italians seem to get a bad rap concerning it. They will let you know that you have been single far too long. And the truth is, even Jesus accepts that marriage is not for everyone. Here in chapter 19 and verse 10, his disciples said to him, "If such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry." And we anticipate from the way marriage is generally handled that Jesus would say, no. That's not what he says, though. But he said to them, "All cannot accept this saying, but only those to whom it has been given." That sounds almost like the ability to be single is a gift that some have. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul describes it exactly that way. That some people are given gifts of various forms, and one of those gifts might very well be the ability to be single forever, to remain single through your life. And there are some benefits to that. In verse 12, he says, "For there are eunuchs who were born thus from their mother's womb, and there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. He who is able to accept it, let him accept it." Paul and Jesus, both excellent examples of individuals, it seems, who refrained from marriage, who were not married. And Paul argues that marriage doesn't solve every problem. In fact, there were going to come a number of problems that Paul's talking about in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, that marriage would be a detriment in the current situation. Now, that's not to say no one should ever be married, but that for individuals who were about to receive the persecution that was coming upon them by Rome, it would likely be better if you were not married. You wouldn't have the same responsibilities. You'd be freer to leave when the time came. You'd have less restrictions in your life. As well, Paul argues that for some, remaining single allows them more freedom to serve God all the time. That they don't have a responsibility to a spouse, to children. They still have familial responsibilities if their mother, for instance, is a widow or whatnot. But there are benefits to not marrying. That you can focus more on being completely God's and serving in His capacity. Additionally, something that sometimes heterosexual marriage is pushed upon people who have homosexual proclivities, as if that is going to solve all of their problems. Might it help? Sure. But it is entirely possible that an individual who enters, hopefully, understandably, with an individual of the opposite sex who understands their situation will be understanding and understand that this marriage might not be like every other marriage. But when it is entered into without understanding, without people understanding the individual situations, perhaps their homosexual proclivities or whatever the case might be, it's going to cause problems. And marriage is not going to solve them. Like when you're married and you're tempted to solve your problems, your marital problems, by having kids. Let's throw gasoline on fire. That's practically what it's like. It always seems like it's a good idea, but that's exactly what it is. Throwing gasoline on fire, because more problems don't solve previous problems. They usually just cover them up until they explode and bigger problems show up. Jesus says marriage is not for everyone. Marriage is designed to be a commitment between a man and a woman. Paul would argue in 1 Corinthians 7, there are certain responsibilities each individual has to the other. But marriage is not just what we think marriage has to be. And by that I mean, it doesn't have to be as emotional. It doesn't have to be as the word I'm looking for. It doesn't have to be exclusively because of sexual interest. There are a number of reasons individuals might get married, to individuals, a man and a woman specifically, according to the Bible. But there are also really good reasons that individuals might remain single. And that is perfectly fine. Perfectly acceptable. Perfectly reasonable. Because commitment is what makes a marriage last, not emotions or sexual interest. In fact, those things all wane with time. Commitment is the only thing that is going to allow that marriage to last in any capacity. And in truth, if you think about it, have you not read relationship with God works exactly the same way? Commitment is what allows a relationship with God to last. The decision to do what is right according to your spouse and according to the marriage that you've been bound to, or the relationship and the commitment that you've put in your relationship with God. And when it comes first, it will give incredible blessings, both marriage to a spouse as well as a relationship with God will bring incredible blessings along the way. But it requires work. It requires effort. It requires commitment. And if you're willing to give it, as we talked about before, fair doesn't matter. what we perceive as fair is rarely actually fair. You could ask my kids, ask them what fair is. They have no idea. Fair is whatever suits me in the moment. That's not fair. Are you kidding me? But that's exactly how we treat it. When we say the word fair, that's what we mean in almost every case. Now, when God deals with what is righteous, that is an entirely different thing altogether. And I'm glad that it's an entirely different thing. And I'm glad, most assuredly, that the Lord has revealed to us all things that pertain to life and godliness, that He has given us His Word, and He has given it to us in a form that we can read and understand, and most importantly, that we can obey. And if you, this morning, need to put on Christ, you need to come into that relationship that you can be blessed through the commitment that you have in Him and the blessings that will come upon you for it, that you can do so this morning. And if we can help you to put on Christ, to come back to Him, to stay faithful to Him, or perhaps to remain faithful to your marriage, to continue steadfastly in what God has called you in or what commitments you have made, whatever we can help you with this morning, I pray that you would let it be known as together we stand and sing. God.